The show you have selected will start directly after the next message.
Exciting news! October sees the launch of the world's first live healthy breakfast show right here on UK Health Radio. Presented by the amazing Dr. Shan Hussein every weekday from 7 till 9 a.m. Also live streamed via YouTube and available on UK Health Radio's Listen on Demand for our global audience. Start your day the healthy way.
Edition of the Yes to Life show here on UK Health Radio. I'm Robin Daly, host for the show and founder of the UK charity Yes to Life that helps people with cancer to access and understand integrative medicine. If there's one thing outside of conventional cancer care that's been making a lot of waves for quite some time, it's cannabis and the various derivatives of cannabis. It's been difficult to get beyond opinion and conjecture to any evidence to base decisions on, particularly regarding dosages and types. But things are now moving with regard to the science, and I've been lucky enough to get biochemist Steve Ottersberg to come on the show today to bring us up to date with the latest understandings and evidence. Please note, there's still a legal situation surrounding some cannabis products in the UK, and also in many other countries where you may be listening, so it's vital you make yourself aware of the law before making any decisions regarding purchase or use. I'm talking to Steve over the phone on the west coast of the US. I see, brilliant to have you on the Yes to Life show.
My pleasure. Here, thanks for having me.
Great. So I'm really inspired to see you at True Fields earlier this year. That's a very British kind of event, I think, isn't it? A bit different to things in the States.
It was great. I absolutely love True Fields. I am looking forward to coming back again next year.
Yep, me too. Okay, so you're a scientist, a biochemist with a special interest in genetics and epigenetics, and you've given a lot of attention to the endocannabinoid system in your work, which has, of course, has led you to be interested in the derivatives of cannabis, CBD, THC, all that kind of stuff, and how these can influence our health, particularly people with cancer. Here in the UK, the law still puts a large dampener on progress in this field, but increasingly in the States, the restrictions have been lifted. What effect has this had in the fields of research and in health generally?
Well, in terms of the legal influences on research have been devastating in my eyes, in terms of, you know, the endocannabinoid system is one of the most fundamental systems of control of homeostasis in the human body and other mammals. And field of study has really been inhibited by the fact that scientists don't have access to the basic tools of research to study the endocannabinoid system. And I think it's a real disservice both to the scientific community, but also to the public who benefit from basic health science.
Hmm. Yeah. So, do you feel things speeding up now?
Yes. I mean, in the past 10 years with, you know, legalization happening in various states in the United States and other countries adopting medical use legalization and decriminalization, I think that it's becoming easier for scientists to study the endocannabinoid system and the effects of the what I refer to as phytocannabinoids, the cannabinoids that are produced by the cannabis plant.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we're starting to scratch the surface on it, but really, all of the research that we have has pretty much come from one lab in Israel, from Raphael McCullum.
Really?
And he's done amazing work. Yeah. Mm. I mean, since 1963, there has been a continuous line of research coming from Raphael McCullum's lab in Israel. And his work is amazing, but the truth of science is, for science to really provide a rich, useful set of data, we have to have multiple research labs working in parallel so that you know, if my research shows one aspect of, you know, this scientific endeavor, I would expect that another researcher in a different lab is going to parallel my research and either confirm or disprove my work. Mm. It's an important part of the scientific process for multiple researchers to be looking at the same thing. And to me, that's the biggest challenge with the laws is the number of labs that are doing the research is too small.
Mm. But it sounds like we got a lot to thank to one location for actually pushing things forward over the last decade or two.
Yeah, Dr. McCullum has been really the backbone of cannabis research globally. Mm-hmm. He definitely needs to be recognized for that.
Right. Okay, so today we're going to be exploring this territory of the interactions between our systems and cannabis derivatives and how this can or does help people who have cancer. So I'd like to cover a few basics first for people not familiar with the territory. Could you start off by just describing what our own endocannabinoid system and its functions as far as we understand them are?
So the endocannabinoid system is a system of fatty acid derivatives. So our essential fatty acids are used for a number of different functions in the human body. One of them is they are converted into endocannabinoids. Endocannabinoids are essential fatty acid derivatives that are produced in our central nervous system, our immune system, and various other cells in the human body. And in the central nervous system, the function of endocannabinoids is they're produced in a manner that's known as postsynaptically, and they're utilized presynaptically. And I know I'm getting into scientific jargon here, but what you have to understand the reason I state it that way is because it's important to understand that endocannabinoids are a control mechanism for neurotransmission, meaning it's like a safety valve or anti-lock brakes. It prevents our central nervous system from over-revving. Mm. And so that's one of the many essential functions of endocannabinoids in the human body is they have a protective mechanism in the central nervous system.
Mm. Very important.
Endocannabinoids are important as modulators of immune function, mm-hmm. meaning that the endocannabinoids can slow or balance immune function. Because you have to understand, normal immune function is the balance between autoimmunity and immune suppression. And there's a large number of immunomodulators produced in the human body, and endocannabinoids are one of that toolbox of immunomodulators that help our immune system to maintain that balance between autoimmunity, which is damaging, and immunosuppression, mm-hmm. which is ineffective.
Right. Interesting. So those are both two really important areas for people with cancer, which I'm sure we're going to go into in a lot more depth. Thank you for that. And
Can I throw in one more?
Yeah.
One more really important aspect of the endocannabinoid system, in this, I think that this is important for all chronic disease, not just cancer.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that I failed to mention about the endocannabinoid system that's important for cancer is a process known as fear extinction.
Mm-hmm.
Fear extinction is the ability to forget a stressful event. And I want to credit another important researcher in cannabis science, a neurologist by the name of Ethan Russo. And I like to quote Ethan. He often says at conferences that one of the most important things about cannabis for cancer patients is the emotional damage that can be incurred from hearing a terminal diagnosis. So
right.
Put yourself in the shoes of a cancer patient who was just delivered a terminal diagnosis. The diagnosis can be emotionally damaging, and that emotional damage can be as detrimental as the tumor itself. And so one of the important things that cannabis offers to cancer patients is simply a stress release. You know, when you are dealing with a terminal diagnosis, and even if it's not terminal, I mean, the dreadfulness of getting a cancer diagnosis is challenging. And I think that dealing with the emotions associated with that is one of the things that is really important that cannabis has to offer.
Well, that, again, really big. So many people talk about that kind of thing, having a terminal diagnosis foisted on them against their will, even when they've actually said they don't want to know.
Yeah.
That is important. Okay, and there's one other thing which more and more people are now familiar with, but just for the avoidance of doubt, could you make the important distinction between genetics and epigenetics?
Yes. So, you know, I think it's important, especially for cancer patients, to know that, you know, often you will hear that cancer is a genetic curse and, you know, it's just the luck of the draw. If you get cancer, you just have bad genes and, you know, there's nothing you can do about it. And the distinction between genetics and epigenetics is that genetics is a static code that we're born with. We're born with a set of genes, and the way that genes work is they are like, you know, you can imagine that your genes are like your hard drive on your computer. Mm-hmm. You have information stored on your hard drive of your computer, but unless you access that information, the information really does nothing, right?
Okay.
You know, and so you could think of your DNA as being the hard drive that stores all of the information, and you could think of epigenetics as the mechanism for accessing that information and translating it into action. You know, if you are an engineer and you're storing the design for an automobile manufacturing plant on a hard drive, mm-hmm. that's the genetics. When you take those blueprints and you print them, that's your RNA, and you build them into functional machines, those are your proteins. And so epigenetics is the study of the expression of genes into proteins and receptors and enzymes that do the work in the human body. And people often ask me, what are epigenetic triggers? Because epigenetics is the expression of genes. Well, there has to be a trigger for the expression of a gene. And the way that our DNA works is everything is an epigenetic trigger. Emotions are epigenetic triggers. The pH of our blood, the salt content of our blood, the temperature around us, the number of days of sunlight, the number of hours of sunlight in the day, the frequency of light in the spectrum that we're exposed to, All of these things are epigenetic triggers that influence how our body expresses the information stored in our DNA.
Right. So, and the lovely message behind that is, of course, we're not some kind of victim of our genes, that actually our environment and all sorts of other factors affect how our health manifests.
Absolutely. Yeah, we're definitely not victims of our genes.
Right.
We have the ability to control our destiny in many ways.
Okay, so the operation of the endocannabinoid system has a lot to do with several important aspects of our experience of life, and the way that we experience life is the foundation of our quality of life. In cancer treatment, quality of life has been seen maybe in the past as very much a nice to have, with life-saving taking center stage, resulting in lots of people who are alive but living very badly, dealing with things like constant pain or other life-destroying symptoms. But increasingly, cancer is now being looked at as something that's containable, and quality of life has moved up a little bit and it's been given more attention, as it should. Would you tell us what you see as the key foundations of quality of life and what part, if any, the endocannabinoid system can play in them?
So we spoke already about fear extinction and dealing with stress as an important quality of life parameter. And I think that I think that that has to be emphasized again. It's so important.
Right.
You know, and I really love that you're coming back to quality of life, because especially for you living in the UK, where regulations are, you know, lagging behind where we are in the US, I think that the quality of life is probably one of the most important things to discuss with people who are sitting on the fence about the benefit of cannabis. You know, like regulators who don't understand cannabis, and they, you know, they think that it's a Schedule I drug like heroin. I think that the place to start with them is, we don't want to go with them and say that cannabis cures diseases. We want to go to them and say cannabis improves the quality of life of cancer patients. And I think that that's the most important. It's important to start the dialogue with the naysayers with something that we can all agree on.
Right.
And I think across the board, it's well understood that cannabis is an important tool for improvement of quality of life in cancer patients.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've spoken about the emotional aspect. The other two aspects of quality of life that I think are important to understand with respect to cannabis is, number one, nausea. Nausea is kind of across the board one of the biggest challenges that cancer patients have.
Right.
You know, whether it's a side effect of chemo and radiation, or whether it's a side effect of, you know, all of the, I want to call them fake hormones that the cancer cells release. Cancer cells actually are relatively smart in terms of physiology, and cancer cells can actually release molecules that interfere with our normal homeostasis. And so cancer patients can be experiencing nausea as a side effect of chemo and radiation, or they can be experiencing nausea from the tumors themselves. And in the toolbox of Western medicine, I don't think that there's any MD oncologist in the world that would tell you that they have an anti-nausea medication that is as effective as cannabis. It just doesn't exist.
Hmm.
And I think that all oncologists recognize this. And so I think it's important that this is part of the dialogue. And so, you know, we talk about anti-nausea. The other really important thing for cancer patients in terms of quality of life that cannabis offers is improvement of appetite. You know, we joke that, oh, ha, 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 you know, cannabis causes the munchies. Well, if you're in a state of metabolic wasting,
right,
and whether that's induced from the tumors or from the drugs, cancer patients just generally don't have an appetite. And so it's important, you know, obviously it's important for people to have good nutrition. Well, if you don't have an appetite, it's difficult to improve your nutrition. And so this is one of the other important aspects that cannabis offers.
Right. So some other areas that I know that people definitely struggle with during cancer or cancer treatment or both, would be energy. Does cannabis have anything to offer there?
Well, I mean, when you think about cannabis can be, you know, kind of broken down into two subclassifications based on their evolutionary origins. And I hesitate to use these terms because they're kind of outdated from the black market. But people recognize these terms, so I kind of have to stick with them.
Okay.
The terms I'm referring to are indica classification and sativa classification of cannabis. And here's where we have to start talking a little bit about the chemistry of cannabis, because the plant cannabis produces cannabinoids. And, you know, most people today understand that cannabinoids are THC, CBD, CBN, CBG, and there's, you know, I think we're up to about 26 different cannabinoids that have been isolated in the cannabis plant.
Right.
And, you know, most people are familiar with THC, so I tended to direct my discussions around THC, the psychoactive cannabinoid, and CBD, the non-euphoric cannabinoid. And so there are cannabinoids produced by the plant, and there are terpenoids produced by the plant. And terpenoids are the flavor and aroma components of the plant kingdom. Mm. So if you like basil, one of the primary flavor components of basil is a terpenoid known as osamine. Citrus, the characteristic flavor and aroma of citrus partially comes from a terpenoid known as limonene. Pinene is the terpenoid that gives pine trees their characteristic flavors and aromas. And, you know, there's 40,000 terpenoids produced in the plant kingdom, so we can't talk about all of them. But the cannabis plant reliably produces about 21 different terpenoids, and the terpenoids can be generalized as stimulant or sedative in nature. For instance, the terpenoid myrcene is considered a sedative, and myrcene has actually been shown to bind to opiate receptors. Mm-hmm. And so when we speak about opiate receptors, I hope that it's obvious to everybody that opiate receptors are a really important part of pain transmission in the human body. And because myrcene binds to opiate receptors, it is likely to be beneficial for patients who are experiencing severe pain. And to come back to the discussion that you brought up about energy, to me, a high myrcene strain of cannabis is probably going to be helpful in sleep and management of, you know, severe chronic pain. And so if we can offer a cancer patient something that's going to help them sleep, mm-hmm. that will likely be a really big boost in their overall energy.
Yes, definitely. Okay, well, that, I mean, you mentioned pain there. That's something I'd like to explore a bit more, because, of course, it's something, yeah, people have got to deal with that one for sure, all different kinds, either, yep. again, directly from the cancer or possibly from the cancer treatment. I'm interested, first of all, in how much of a resource cannabis can be for that. And it seems like you're saying, well, you have to be quite specific about the type of cannabis derivative that you use.
Yes, absolutely. And so I want to go back to a generalization that I use for patients who are interested in using cannabis, who have never tried cannabis. Mm-hmm. And my generalization is, if you're going to try cannabis for pain, for sleep, for emotional support, for any aspect of quality of life, I always recommend starting out with a low THC form. And so I know that in the UK there is hemp available, and hemp, so I think it's important to understand that hemp and cannabis, or marijuana as we refer to it in the United States, are all the same plant. Mm-hmm. The difference is hemp has been selectively bred to produce low THC. Cannabis or marijuana has been selectively bred to produce high THC. And I shy away from recommending first-time users to try high THC preparations, because the epigenetic response to THC varies dramatically from person to person.
Right.
So your response to THC can be dramatically different than my response to THC. I can have an overwhelmingly positive response to THC, and you can have an overwhelmingly negative response to THC. The response to CBD, because CBD is non-euphoric, and I want to make the distinction that I refer to CBD as non-euphoric, because there are a lot of people that refer to CBD as non-psychoactive, and that's incorrect.
Okay.
CBD is psychoactive, and the scientific term for the type of psychoactivity that CBD elicits is called anxiolytic. Mm-hmm. Anxiolytic means anti-anxiety. Mm. And to me, the anxiolytic effect of CBD is a very important psychoactive effect of CBD.
Right.
So imagine if you have a cancer diagnosis, would an anxiolytic compound be beneficial? Yeah. I think that that's an overwhelming yes.
Definitely.
Yeah, and so back to my rule of thumb with recommending cannabis use, I always recommend for people to start with a high CBD form, which generally comes from hemp. And after about 4 or 5 days of consuming a high CBD form, if you don't feel like you're getting enough of the emotional support, if you're not getting enough of the pain relief, if you're not getting enough, you know, improvement of your sleep, after you've been on a high CBD preparation for 5 days, then add in small amounts of THC to that and titrate your THC dose up very slowly so that you can see how your body is going to respond. Does that make sense?
It does make sense, yeah. Thank you. Well, that's a good bit of a structured approach to something which a lot of people just have no idea where to start. So that's great. All right. So on the pain thing, I've got a bit of a sort of chicken and egg question I wanted to ask. So say I've got a pain that's caused by a genuine physical situation, let's say nerve damage through chemotherapy, an intervention in the endocannabinoid system maybe could change our experience of that pain. So can this improved experience also have a reverse effect on the actual source of the pain?
Well, that's a great question. I think it's important to understand the mechanism of endocannabinoids and phytocannabinoids. And so these molecules known as endocannabinoids and the molecules known as phytocannabinoids, in science, we refer to them as promiscuous.
Okay.
Not because they go out on Saturday night and come home too late. We refer to them as promiscuous because let's look at THC as an example. THC binds to the CB1 receptor. THC binds to the CB2 receptor. THC also binds to a receptor known as the transient vanilloid receptor. And THC also binds to opiate receptors. And so because it binds to a large number of receptors, we call it promiscuous. Mm-hmm. Now, if you're not familiar with the transient vanilloid receptors, these receptors are important for the sensation of heat and pressure.
Okay.
And I think it's pretty well commonly understood that opiate receptors are important in the transmission of pain.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's the receptor binding properties of THC. Our endocannabinoids, arachidonal ethanolamide, otherwise known as anandamide, and 2-arachidonyl glycerol are fatty acid derivatives that also bind to these receptors. And you have to understand, when you think about how the endocannabinoid system works, these molecules known as endocannabinoids are released and they are transported and then they bind to their receptors. And after they bind to their receptors, they are broken down. And so the synthesis of the endocannabinoid, the rate of synthesis of the endocannabinoid and the rate of the breakdown of the endocannabinoid determine the life of that endocannabinoid in the synapse where pain transmission happens. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Okay. Now, in terms of pain, we talked about the crossover of receptor binding of these molecules. It turns out that the breakdown of endocannabinoids crosses over with a class of molecules known as eicosanoids. And you know eicosanoids because of the class of drugs known as NSAIDs. NSAID stands for non-steroidal anti-inflammatory.
Hmm.
And non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like aspirin, ibuprofen, diclofenac, they block the conversion of arachidonic acid into the mediators of pain, inflammation, fever, and blood clotting. And so the significance with the endocannabinoid system is that the enzymes that break down the eicosanoid mediators of pain and inflammation and fever that are blocked by NSAIDs, they also break down endocannabinoids. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And so there are some researchers that believe that there is a slight antidepressant effect from taking aspirin or ibuprofen because they block the breakdown of endocannabinoids.
Right.
And remember that the first endocannabinoid that was discovered, arachidonyl ethanolamide, has been given the name anandamide based on the ananda or ananda in Sanskrit means bliss. And so it was recognized early on in the research of endocannabinoids that arachidonyl ethanolamide improves the mood in organisms that have the endocannabinoid system.
Hmm.
So I know that was a long, convoluted trail around pain, but does that help make sense that pain transmission has multiple pathways and the endocannabinoid system is involved in many of them?
In many of them, yeah. So it's interesting territory, isn't it? You know, this more and more we hear about things that we always thought of as being one-way systems are actually two-way systems. You know, there was a thought that everything, all the instructions were coming out from the brain, for example, or it was experiencing things coming into it. But actually, you know, it's been found out more recently that no, things work both ways, you know, between, say, the brain and the gut, for example.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm.
Yeah, there's a lot of parallel communication in the central nervous system, and there's a lot of two-way communication in the central nervous system that has largely been overlooked.
Mm. One thing that I've just remembered from very many years ago was a maverick doctor working in the territory of cancer and doing something that certainly seemed pretty outlandish at the time. He'd profile a cancer patient's neurotransmitters against the kind of baseline of what a healthy person would have, and then he'd seek to restore their levels to normal. And he claimed that this would actually have a direct effect on resolving the disease. I mean, you know, I don't know whether he was completely out to lunch or what, but interesting, though.
Yeah. Well, can we go back to genetics?
Are you sure?
So, you know, why I want to go back is because when you're talking about pain, one of the things that comes up in my mind is chronic pain and acute pain both can be really detrimental emotionally.
Sure.
You know, when people are dealing with pain, it compounds any of their emotional challenges that they have. I think that that's really well understood. But the reason I wanted to go back to genetics is because you jogged my memory about a specific gene. So, you know, when you think about the stress response, we typically classify the stress response in terms of neurotransmitters as being the stress response is a release of adrenaline or epinephrine and cortisol. And so adrenaline or epinephrine, these molecules are neurotransmitters that are released and then degraded. One of the enzymes that degrades adrenaline and epinephrine is an enzyme called COMT. And this is a really well-studied enzyme because it also is involved in the breakdown of estrogen. And so there's another connection with cancer. In the last 10 years, there was a study that came out that showed that women with polymorphisms, and a polymorphism is a fancy way of saying a mutation that influences the function of the enzyme, polymorphisms in the gene for COMT that breaks down dopamine and epinephrine and adrenaline, these genetic polymorphisms have been shown to influence the outcome of cancer. And so women with COMT polymorphisms tend to have a higher rate of recurrence or breast and ovarian cancer.
Mm.
And that comes from observational trials. There was recently, in the last 10 years, a study that showed that women on beta blockers for blood pressure management have a lower risk of recurrence if they have the COMT polymorphisms. Mm. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And so you have to understand that beta blockers block adrenaline at the receptor site. So beta blockers are blocking the adrenaline from binding to adrenergic receptors. And COMT polymorphisms slow the breakdown of adrenaline. And so if you have a COMT mutation that slows the function of your COMT, you will tend to basically be bathing in a soup of adrenaline. Meaning when you go through the stress response, your body releases adrenaline and cortisol.
Right.
And the more quickly you can metabolize that adrenaline and cortisol, the less damage that stress response will have.
Hmm.
If you go through the stress response, you release adrenaline and cortisol, but you're slow to metabolize adrenaline and cortisol, your stress response will be more damaging.
Hmm. So that's like you can look at your response to stress and consider that could have a relationship to your ability to come out of cancer treatment well.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that it's pretty well understood, both among lay people in the medical community, that stress is a major contributor to all chronic disease.
Yes.
I don't think that there's a person living today that would deny that stress is harmful. And as a contributor to chronic disease.
But it's really interesting to hear about the mechanisms that are involved here, because it's, you know, the general understanding is that, yeah, it seems to, we're not quite sure why. But you're actually pointing to, well, exactly why it might be.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it's a really well-characterized pathway that, you know, if you can't metabolize your stress hormones, though, you're going to be in a stressful state for most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, you know, I've done a lot of coaching of patients in NASHA's practice, and I've seen a lot of women with breast and ovarian cancer that have multiple mutations in the genes that are responsible for the management of stress hormones, and it's pretty clear, you know, that women in this patient population that have these gene mutations don't accommodate stress well.
Mm-hmm. Really interesting.
I tend to say that they're emotionally brittle.
Mm, that's a good way of describing it. Mm. That's really interesting. And just for listeners who don't actually know, you're referring to Nasha Winters there, Dr. Nasha Winters, who of course is one of my regular guests on the show, whose partner you are.
She's my wife, correct.
Yeah. Okay. So, always with any intervention, there's kind of two big variables at play. The intervention itself, which we can vary the dosage, the combinations of frequency, etc., etc. And then there's the particular human being who receives it, their genetics, their unique response to that particular intervention at that time in their particular state of health. It's all extraordinarily complicated and a kind of moving target for practitioners to work with. Could you tell us a bit about some of the recent developments to help with navigating this terrain and the ways in which recent understandings can influence decision-making?
So I think that genetic testing is probably one of the most important developments in our understanding of the variability of response from patient to patient for any drug that they take.
Mm.
And in the pharmaceutical industry today, there are more and more drugs that in the prescribing information for the drug, there is a pharmacogenomics section, which lists genes that have been characterized as influencers of the outcome of the drug.
Right.
And so I would recommend that if anybody is going to take any drug, they seek the advice of a competent pharmacist that understands pharmacogenomics. And I stress pharmacists because most MDs have zero training in pharmacogenomics. And if they know anything about it, they've taken it upon themselves to learn.
Hmm.
Pharmacists, on the other hand, are taught pharmacogenomics in their training, and it's part of their normal curriculum.
Hmm.
So I want to focus on one particular gene known as the cytochrome 2C9. Cytochrome 2C9 is a well-characterized gene that influences the disposition of a large number of drugs. And so it's hard to dispute this evidence because it's really strong evidence. So the gene cytochrome 2C9 is also responsible for the metabolism of THC and is largely responsible for the variation in response of edible THC preparations. And it's important to understand that edible preparations can be very beneficial, but they're highly unpredictable. And the reason they're highly unpredictable is because the other aspect of the cytochrome 2C9 gene that is important to understand is that we refer to cytochrome 2C9 as a highly polymorphic gene. So if we had six people in a room, each one of those people could have a different mutation on the 2C9 gene. And so the gene mutations of the 2C9 are classified based on their activity. Mm-hmm. So I am an ultra slow variant of cytochrome 2C9. My dog sitting next to me, she could be an intermediate slow. Then the next person in the room could be a slow, then normal, then there's fast, intermediate fast, ultra fast. Do you see where I'm getting at with this?
Lots of variants, yeah.
Lots of variation due to genetics in this gene. And so when I consume THC orally, I can tolerate it relatively well because I'm a slow metabolizer based on my 2C9 profile. If I were a fast metabolizer based on my 2C9 genetics, I would not likely tolerate edible THC because what cytochrome 2C9 does is it converts delta-9 THC into 11-hydroxy-THC. And the problem with that is delta-9 THC is relatively predictable, and it's predictable in terms of response because in most people, it has a predictable 3 to 4 hour half-life in human plasma, whereas 11-hydroxy-THC, the metabolite of 2C9, has a half-life that varies from 7 to 72 hours, and 11-hydroxy-THC is estimated to be about 4 times more psychoactive than delta-9 THC. And so if you consume an edible, number one, we don't know how quickly the onset of action is going to be. We don't know the duration of action, and we don't know the intensity of the psychoactive effect. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And if we can run a genetic test, 23andMe used to report 2C9, and they don't anymore. My friend Alex Swanson has a company called Nutrition Genome. They report a number of cannabis response genes. The company Endocana Health reports a number of cannabis response genes. And so I recommend getting a test like Nutrition Genome ran so that you at least know what variants of the cytochrome 2C9 you have that could influence cannabis response.
Right.
One of the genes that's reported that has been shown to influence cannabis response is the CB1 receptor gene. You know, there's a small percentage of people who have mutations of their CB1 receptor who are highly susceptible to schizophrenia from cannabis consumption.
Right.
And so I think probably the most important development in our understanding of dosing and frequency of cannabis is going to be genetic testing.
Mm-hmm. Well, it certainly sounds like it's taking quite a bit of the guesswork out of it.
It's starting to.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have to understand it is an emerging field. And so, you know, it's not perfect at this point, but we have a lot more information to guide us today than we did 5 or 10 years ago.
Yeah.
you know, and with science, the more we can feed the scientific method, the more we can understand how to eliminate the variables in response.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we just got a few minutes left. I just wanted to ask at the end. So we've spoken largely, as you advised in a way, because this is a British audience, about cannabinoids and all the symptoms and side effects that people have to deal with in cancer, for which there's a pretty good basis in science now. But the other reason, of course, people are taking cannabis derivatives when they got cancer is for its anti-cancer effect, which is more contentious and probably less established in science. Would you like to tell us where you think we are now with this second reason for taking it? How much credibility do cannabinoid medicines deserve for its use in controlling cancer?
I think that the credibility of cannabinoids in cancer therapy is growing.
Mm-hmm.
I had the honor of giving a talk at the Rocky Mountain Neurological Society conference, and the focus of the conference was glioblastoma.
Mm-hmm.
And at that conference, I presented a mouse study, and I want to emphasize mouse study. In this mouse study, they showed some very significant findings in terms of the extension of life of these mouse that had they had been artificially grafted with glioblastomas.
Right.
And so they saw a longer lifetime with these mice. And the interesting thing was what they observed was they gave these mice different ratios of CBD to THC.
Yeah.
And what they observed was that there was a specific ratio of CBD to THC that made the cannabis preparation as effective as the standard of care drug known as TMZ.
Wow.
So there was a ratio of THC to CBD that was as effective as the standard of care drug in terms of reduction of tumor volume and extension of lifetime. And when they hit the magical ratio of THC to CBD in these mice, it improved the lifespan of these mice beyond that of the standard of care drug.
Wow.
And granted, this is a mouse study.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's important to recognize that we are seeing evidence like this that is showing that cannabis preparations are important. They do have anti-tumor efficacy. And we're not getting these pilot studies into human trials as they should because of the legal nature.
Hmm. So it sounds like it really needs to happen. I mean, that's plenty good reason to do a human study, isn't it? A trial like that with a disease as bad as glioblastoma.
Yeah, when we see this, you know, data as promising as this in mice, it's important that we do get this into human trials.
Mm.
Absolutely.
And a quick question is, do you speculate that particular ratio is a magic ratio that works for human beings, or say mice in this case, sorry, or is it cancer specific?
That's a good question. You know what? I don't think we have a firm enough understanding to really state that, but I think that this is something that's been intuitively known within the cannabis world for years. I mean, you know, I owned a cannabis testing lab in Colorado for 4 years, and through that time, I often heard, you know, people in the cannabis industry talking about the magic ratio of CBD to THC. And I often just took that as what I call bro science.
Yes.
You know, there's a lot of that in the cannabis industry, but you have to understand that in the herbal medicine world, a lot of what we know came from observation.
Right.
you know, empirical observation of, you know, originally the shaman in many cultures, their job was to follow the kids that ate poisonous herbs and see what the outcome was.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and so we have a lot of empirical evidence around cannabis and other herbs, and science is catching up to, okay, some of this stuff that we have observed from people who may not be credible scientists is turning out to be actual valid truth.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay. Fascinating stuff, Steve. I think we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks so much for showing us around, you know, what can be pretty confusing territory, but one that a lot of people want to know more about. So big thank you to you.
Absolutely. My pleasure. I hope that I dispelled some myths and helped to relieve some of the confusion.
I'm pretty sure you did.
Great.
Goodbye.
Thanks a lot, Robin. Have a good day.
Well, I learnt a lot from that discussion, and I hope you found it informative too. It does seem that the hype around cannabis is pretty well justified, although misinformation is also out there in spades. But now some solid ground to base usage on is beginning to take shape. Thanks for joining me today. I shall be back with another expert guest from the world of integrative medicine and cancer next week. So do make a point of joining me again on the Yes to Life show here on UK Health Radio. Goodbye.